This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you very much. Don't applaud too much. I'm not the reader. I'm only the introducer. And thank you for coming. Before I begin, I'd like to say a brief word of heartfelt thanks to the Lannan Foundation, Patrick Lannan, everyone there, particularly to Joe, to Christy, and to Kristen, for getting me here with characteristic Lannan warmth. And the Lannan Foundation, as you will know, is a great agent for change around the world, tirelessly identifying and encouraging all that is positive and never abandoning faith, even in these negative times, in the potential of the right words and the right deeds to make possible a more just, tolerant, and sustainable planet. The readings and conversations series, of which tonight is the latest, have spread their word well beyond Santa Fe by means of the Lannan website. And speaking of websites, I'm very glad to say that we have the co-founders of the great original poetry website, Poetry Daily, are both here with us. That's Diane Bowler, or Bowler, to get the name right. I'm giving an Irish pronunciation. And Don Selby. And they're very welcome, as indeed is Eamon Grennan's editor from Grey Wolf, Jeff Schatz. And of course, everybody here is extremely and warmly welcome, and not least our outreach students tonight. Anyway, my words of introduction to Eamon Grennan. St. Patrick's Day, as you may be aware, isn't quite here yet, but it's on the way. And the first sure sign of green shoots in the air, or a green tinge rather than a white snow tinge in the air, my forecast is for green weather. And the first sure sign of that weather coming is two Irish men in town. And even if I weren't a typically talkative Irishman, I'd find it impossible to encapsulate tonight's guest, Eamon Grennan, in a single word. Even the word Irish doesn't tell the whole story by any means. I'm inclined, therefore, to settle on the most apt word and the most obvious one, which is poet. But exactly what kind of poet do we encounter tonight in the Lensic? Insofar as he keeps homes near the Connemara seaboard and close to the Hudson River, the description Celtic amphibian has been applied to him. Since he's a translator as well as a poet, critic as well as teacher, I'm wondering about the word ambidextrous. And then there's the fact that, as a poet, he lovingly recalls everyday details, but also is alert to the visionary dimension of the world. So I'm wondering, could we call him bifocal? And then, taking account of the fact that he spent so much of his life in America, while also keeping an Irish home and an Irish passport, I'm wondering, should I be using the word bilocation somewhere in the introduction as well? But anyway, before I confuse you any further trying to find the right word, I must attempt to describe the kind of poetry he writes. Eamon Grennan is a poet who has erudition and scholarship aplenty, holding a PhD from Harvard, no less, where his thesis was on the history plays of Shakespeare, no less. But although his learning, naturally and properly, informs what he writes, it never comes between him and his non-specialist readers, many of whom have been drawn to his work by his acclaimed appearances in the New Yorker magazine. Although clarity and lucidity are hallmarks of Eamon Grennan's work, I have to confess that not all of the words that he uses can be found in the dictionary. But those that can't be found in the dictionary are made up of those that are, because he's very adept at using kind of compound words or portmanteau words, as James Joyce would call them. He'd take a couple of familiar words and create a new word, achieving a kind of inspired phonetic synthesis and linguistic synergy from the result. Only a poet with the greatest possible urge to capture every sight and sound around him with the utmost precision would resort so plaintively and so ingeniously and so single-mindedly to such coinages. And these compounds blazing across his pages greatly enrich our sense of the amplitude and multiplicity, the variety and fecundity of our planet. Eamon's compound inventions are really the impasto brushstrokes of a poet who is fascinated by visual art. From primitive cave paintings to Bonnard's sumptuous, eye-nourishing breakfasts. In Eamon's latest collection, a larger edition of which will appear in America in May, entitled Matter of Fact, the Irish edition is called Out of Breath, has two poems that actually end with the word look in the last line. And there are no better lookers, no better looking poets than Eamon Grennan, one might say, many of whose painterly poems show him frame by window, intently observing the everyday world. In one poem, we see through Vermeer's eyes the view from Eamon Grennan's childhood bedroom in Dublin, the city where he, that's to say, Eamon Grennan, not Vermeer, was born in 1941. Eamon is the son of a schools inspector and a mother who sang a lot. So he must have been very pleased when an American critic, or poetry inspector, as we might be tempted to call some critics, wrote of Eamon's poems, which are intensely musical as well as visual. The critic said, Grennan is contemporary poetry's equivalent of a fine Irish tenor, which could come in pretty handy around St. Patrick's Day, I would think, but anyway. Among the earlier schools that Eamon attended was one situated in Dublin between a morgue and an orphanage, two destinations that a child mightn't want to dwell on or dwell in for too long, unless, of course, he intended to be a poet when he grew up. In his teens, Eamon attended boarding school for 5 years at a Cistercian college in Tipperary, where he became a talented athlete, running, jumping, captaining the rugby team. His athletic skills were more than matched by his academic and literary feats. His university education began with a degree in English and Italian at University College Dublin, where he edited the student literary magazine. He went to Italy for a year on a scholarship and taught English to air traffic controllers who would use it in life or death situations as crucial a test of the power of language as any poem. And of course, proving himself, this is really limp now, to be a poetic high flyer, Eamon went on to publish many individual collections of poems, from Wiley for Days in 1983 to the brand new Out of Breath, Our Matter of Fact, in 2008. His 2002 collection, Still Life with Waterfall, received one of America's major awards, the Lenore Marshall. In addition, he's published a selection of Leopardi's poems in translation, which won the Penn Translation Award, and an indispensable book of essays on Irish poetry called Facing the Music. Most of Eamon's working life was spent at Vassar College in upstate New York, from which he retired recently. He's now free to spend more time in his cottage in Connemara in the wild west of Ireland. When in residence there as a poet, he can be found recording the plant life and the bird life and eavesdropping on the run-on sentences of the waves. If I speak for much longer, it'll be St. Patrick's Day already. So, having begun by trying to encapsulate Eamon's poems in my own words, I feel I should end by letting his words provide a kind of self-portrait of the poems. In his newest book, he writes of a heron in terms which could equally apply to his own poems. Watching a heron's flight, he's prompted to reflect on how we use our airy words to lift us above the dragging elements we live in, toward an understanding eloquent and silent. Eamon Grennan's poems achieve something as extraordinary as that. Poems in which the ordinary particulars of the world are spelled out so lovingly, so precisely, so rhythmically, that they become transformed into timeless truths and insights. This is Eamon's second appearance in the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversations series. His previous reading took place almost 11 years ago. So there's a great deal of poetic news to catch up with from this intriguingly inventive poet, especially since he's an artist who is always developing and experimenting, pushing out the boundaries of his line lengths and testing out new formal possibilities. So, high time I allowed you to listen to Eamon Grennan presenting his own work in his own words, introducing it, reading it to you, and I'd invite you to welcome Eamon Grennan. Thank you.
I think that's it. It's rare that one is alive to hear that kind of nice thing being said about one. But on the strength of that, I have just hired Dennis to write my obituary. So hope you're ready for that, Dennis. Anyway, thank you so much. That was a rare pleasure. I had to cover my ears from time to time, but in order not to commit the sin of vanity in Lent. But thanks very much, Dennis, and also to second what you said in your thankings to the Lannan Foundation, the Medici of the Southwest, which has been quite an extraordinary gift to so many of us in Ireland, in that island, as it has been to the regions of America, obviously. And to thank Christy, Kirsten and company at the foundation for their careful management of this. It seems to me Albuquerque and Santa Fe, well, Santa Fe, not Albuquerque, really, is a kind of sui generis city, which I'm really pleased to come back to. I've been here twice now, and it's lovely for a couple of days to escape the winter, for one thing, although apparently tomorrow you're going to get a little taste of what I escaped in Poughkeepsie. Escaping the winter into the sunshine of today was a bit like a lyric interlude, and for me, because I'll go back to the other place very shortly. But I'm going to read poems that come from various areas of what I've done. Many of you may have read bits and pieces, but not an awful lot across the trajectory of my own work. So I'll read for 2.5 hours and try to get through. I have four books here, so is that okay? So the first poem is since I am so pleased to be in this place, it's a poem about a very different place, but it's a poem about coming back to the place I live in when I go back to Ireland, which is out in the west of Ireland, which, as Dennis has shown, is not where I'm from, but where I have chosen to be. It's out in Connemara, and it's just a small moment of pleasure that you get when you return to the place that you love. I mentioned a couple of things like ruins of cottages and so on. And all across the west of Ireland in particular, you'll see the ruins of cottages, which are signs and portents, essentially, on the landscape of hardships of one kind or another, going back to the famine, many of them. I mentioned a pheasant, a male pheasant. The pheasant was imported into Ireland in the 17th century. So it, too, is a blow-in, like me, but it is far more exotic than I'd ever be. But to see a peasant, to see a pheasant, see lots of, we don't use the word peasant, see a pheasant in that landscape is always to be struck by the counterpoint and contrast between its exotic nature and the kind of hardness of that space with its grey rock and its often barren fields. Anyway, small poem. Place. First morning back, there's a faint cap of cloud on the brow of Tully Mountain, flash of a blackbird between sycamore and ash, glint of dew on a few daisies the scythe has spared. Lilies of the valley stand in a battered can, the cover of my mother's prayer book wrinkles with light, and my neighbour's rickety mutt mumbles a crust of stale bread. In early sunshine, the houses across the lake seem solid as chateaus, seem as if they'd stand forever. High-arched, their barns are granaries of light, though the old cottages lie like bones over the open fields. And here, slightly apologetic, comes the cough of the cock pheasant, stepping among potato drills as if he owned the place, crimson and cinnabar his head, his feathers cinnamon and gold. He will hide in his own life down there, where whins and heather and boggy grass can flourish, and a sunny morning be sheer heaven to him. So to move from the life to the art is a fairly easy step. The art I'm going to move to here is, because I write a bit about paintings and so on, is a very early art. Dennis mentioned it, in fact, cave painters. And as you know, those extraordinary accounts of man's and women's inhabitation of the earth are registered for us in these caves in Lascaux and southern France and southern and northern Spain. And they've always fascinated. And, you know, what I do here is just a little bit of speculation about their composition. I mention monks, Irish monks, actually, because I kind of associate the monks of Ireland in the 10th and 12th centuries and making their, in their monasteries, making their illuminated manuscripts with the cave painters. They're in their own, monks are in their own sort of caves. And birds have, and I'm thinking of migratory patterns of birds as they move back and across the, across the earth. Anyway, it's called the cave painters. Holding only a handful of rushlight, they pressed deeper into the dark, at a crouch, until the great rock chamber flowered around them, and they stood in an enormous womb of flickering light and dark light, a place to make a start. Raised hands cast flapping shadows over the sleeker shapes of radiance. They've left the world of weather and panic behind them and gone on in, drawing the dark in their wake, pushing as one pulse to the core of stone. The pigments mixed in big shells are crushed ore, petals and pollens, berries, and the binding juices oozed out of chosen barks. The beasts begin to take shape from hands and feather tufts soaked in ochre, manganese, madder, mallow white, stroking the live rock, letting slopes and contours mold those forms from chance, coaxing rigid dips and folds and bulges to lend themselves to necks, bellies, swelling haunches, a forehead or a twist of horn, tails and manes curling to a crazy gallop. Intent and human, they attach the mineral, vegetable, animal realms to themselves, inscribing the one unbroken line everything depends on. From that impenetrable center to the outer intangibles of light and air, even the speed of the horse, the bison's fear, the arc of gentleness the big-bellied cow arches over a spindling calf, or the lancing dance of death that bristles out of the buck's struck flank. On this one line they leave a beak-headed human figure of Styx and one small, chalky, human hand. We'll never know if they worked in silence, like people praying, the way our monks illuminated their own dark ages in cross-hatched rocky cloisters, where they contrived a binding labyrinth of lit affinities to spell out in nature's lace and fable their mindful, blinding sixth sense of a god of shadows, or whether, like birds tracing their great bloodlines over the globe, they kept a constant gossip up of praise, encouragement, complaint. It doesn't matter. We know they went with guttering rushlight into the dark, came to terms with the given world. Must have had, as their hands moved steadily by spiderlight, one desire we'd recognize. They would, before going on, beyond this border zone, this nowhere that is now here, leave something upright and bright behind them in the dark. And there's, to move to another painting, but a much more modern one, or another sort of, it's a kind of genuflection that I'm making in some ways in front of a visual art that to me is an extraordinary act of registering the world, giving back the world. In some way, even abstract art is giving back the world something of its own nature, I think. And I like the responsiveness of art in that respect. And I find it in visual arts very often. Here's a poem called Painter's Diary. And the painter I have in mind is Bonnard. So the little bits in the painting that I've invented a diary from are just mentions. It's a little 13-line poem. Painter's Diary. Notations only. Dog star weather. Marble tiles. Shutters. A vase of marigolds glowing in the dusk. Dark outline of a leg curve. Flesh-coloured streak of arms. Hedges lemon blue. Spheres of gleam where trees were. Or a razor's telling edge of light at the door jamb. One smudged hand holding a cut pomegranate. On the mirrored tablecloth, he finds the broken white of a dress and its bone-coloured buttons. Half-open doors. Silver twist of olive leaves after rain. Flesh underwater. Eyes behind glass. Thirsty cloudburst of azure grapes. Soon enough, he thinks, they're dust. But just look at them, shining now in the great breath of things and night coming. A gathering of light and air. A mouth. Dusk glow. Gold of marigolds. Right, I'll move from art to the animal kingdom because I'm doing a little smorgasbord here of stuff that I attend to, and one of the things I attend to or pay attention to are the animals and the creatures in the world, to varying effect probably. This one is I'm going to read it. It's a three-part poem about horses. Springing from horses, and a part of it does a little riff on my childhood fear of horse. I've never ridden a horse, but childhood fear, and then horse. The second part is horseness, as it were. The third part comes about by just looking at horses that I see in the farm a field across the road from where I live, and I just watched the mare and her foal. Anyway. I'll read the poem. Horses. Love these titles, don't you? They intrigue. They're enigmatic. Horses. One. Although they seldom muscled above me, I remember being dwarfed always in the stone fountain of their force. Rawly afraid, awestruck at something vast, a violence harnessed and hauling a cart of scrap metal through our tidy suburb, men with wild, weather-beaten faces snapping the reins. The necks, thick-branching grace, I remember, and the fleshed bones in their legs that I saw from the footpath or once watching a blacksmith bend them in a forge in Terenure and lift one and fold it neatly over in his aproned lap and touch the crescent foot with a big file or pliers, the instrument a glimmer in his blunt hand, the whole horse bulk rippling into shadow. A few times, too, I felt tender, rough lips touch my hand that held flat-handed a snatch of grass, fearing the teeth, but staying still until grass gone in a quick crunch. I had my hand back to pat the silky nose, finger-comb the mane, slap sleek hindquarters, and the belly, big as a curragh, to feel the heat shimmering there, the nervous flickering along skin as if the veins were charged, the blood itself electric, and knowing how heavy the flesh was from the way my hand lay on it, like nothing, a straw on water. I'd imagine it all falling on me, or being lost under a flail of hooves, the feel of so much live, involuntary flesh capsized over my own bones in a fury of bared gums, a trampling froth storm white at the mouth, two black moon-mad eyes on fire. Two. Remote, perfect, overwhelming, how they inhabit space by crowding out the air they occupy, and yet contained, confined inside some glorious force field of their own, a solidified smell of oats, sweat, leather, contemplation, astonishment. The span and ponder of them absolute in anchorage, taut as propellers, steady in that massive confidence of rump and hindquarters, thews bulging, everything sinewy, roped, rounded as seashells, the grand parallelogram of the head, giving millstone definition to the word skull. Three. Two white horses in a field up the road, the mare and her colt gleaming out of the clouded day, at grass, in a windless, wide silence, the tenderness between them palpable as that mild and serious something in an empty chapel. The young one is lying down while his mother browses a close circle round him. But when she stops to stare at the sound my footsteps make on the road beyond the hedge at the edge of their world, the little one rises too and stands looking, his two coal-black eyes lingering on my strange shape, letting out of his lustrous ebony muzzle a faint, plaintive, interrogative whickering. I know they're abroad in every weather, wind snapping at all corners of the valley, rain squalls making ditches roar, sunshine cooking the air in clover. And it is for them only weather, to be taken with the same dense patience they proffer to whatever happens, although at intervals under a heavy shower, after they've been standing as still as creatures carved in quartz, the mare will suddenly toss and gallop round the fuchsia bush and barbed wire border of the field, her colt quickly following, his new legs slow and a little stiff at first, but then with a springy kicking bound and a careless, elegant animation of everything that makes the body and the body move, he'll cut to a perfect dash, tucked tight to a tandem gallop, doubling his mother on the run, picking up as he goes whatever he knows from her. But first, how to warm the blood she's given him, and then how to be increasingly in the world. And the other, a little down the scale of the fauna, is this a couple of little poems about cats. We have cats. I'm not a cat person, really, but I have grown to accommodate our pair as they have been with us. So here's two little poems suggesting the different aspects of the cat. A couple of the different, because there's about a million aspects, but two of them I'm going to concentrate on here. One is the cat as murderer, and I'll read that now. There's no title on this poem. It's from a book that has no titles in the poems at all. I kind of gave up after things like horses and, you know. It strikes me now. I didn't know then. But anyway, this is this little poem. When the cat comes in mewling with a baby rabbit, limp in its jaws like a toy thing unwound, fast asleep, you have to wonder about the way the world is. bright teeth, open eyes, pink mouth, the furry warmth of the small clean corpse you'll carry into the woods and leave there, the light of a full moon glinting in those fine-finished, wide-awake eyes that have lived through a week or so of pure astonishment before the crash of grass blades, sharp, quick trap of teeth closing over a last gasp, and the cat coming in with its gift. You know the way they leave it on your bed? It is true. It's a gift. And this is called Cat Scat. And I mean scat in a number of musical and other ways. And it's a sort of sonnet insofar as it has 14 lines, but this is kind of the same sound at the end of all the lines. So you'll catch that. Cat Scat. I'm watching Cleo listening, our cat, listening to Mozart's magic flute. What can she be hearing? What can the air carry into her ears like that? Her ears swiveling like radio dishes that are tuned to all the noise of the world. Flat and sharp, high and low, a scramble of this and that. She can decode like nobody's business, acrobat of random airs as she is. Although, of course, a bat is better at it, sifting out of its acoustic habitat the sound of the very shape of things automatically, and on the wing at that, the magic flute. What a joy it is, I feel, and wonder to end this little scat. Does or can the cat? Okay, that's my cat, my cats. And here, even further down, the line in the fauna business is... I'd written a lot of elegies for a book, and towards the end of doing these, I paid attention to... No, I was in a museum and saw a piece of amber, fossilized amber, and in it was a fossilized ant. And underneath it said, 80 million years old. And I thought, well, that kind of puts things in perspective. With all the human stuff that I was talking about, and we know about ants, they're before us, and they will be after us. So this was a kind of just paying close attention to the ants. The ants in question are universal ants, of course, but in fact they were up in Maine. No, up in New Hampshire. So the New Hampshire ants, but they could be anywhere. I've mentioned a few names. Antinous was a classical figure, beloved of Hadrian, very beautiful young man. So he just gets in there as a name, whose statue is all over the world, all over the classical world. And I mention Alcibiades, who was the beloved young man of Socrates. And then I mention Isaac, who's Isaac, Isaac Abraham's Isaac. And I mention honeydew, which is not the melon, but the stuff that the queen excretes for the baby ants. Okay, so that's here. Ants. Sorry, I have to acknowledge this from time to time. A black one drags the faded remains of a moth backwards over pebbles under blades of grass. Frantic with invention, it's a seething gene of stubborn order, its code containing no surrender, only this solitary working frenzy that's got you on your knees with wonder, peering into the sheer impedimentary soul in things, and into the gimlet will that dredges the dead moth to where their dwelling is, the sleepy queen's fat heart like a jellied engine, throbbing at the heart of it, her infants simmering towards the light. On your table, a tiny red one picks at a speck of something and hurries away. One of its ancestors walked all over the eyes of Antinous, tickled Isaac's throat, or scuttled across the pulse of Alcibiades, turning up at the cross with a taste for blood. In a blink, one enters your buried mother's left nostril, brings a message down to your father's spine and shiny clavicle, or spins as if dizzy between your lover's salt breasts, running its quick, indifferent body, ragged over the hot tract of her, scrupulous and obsessive into every pore. And here's one in your hairbrush, nibbling at filaments of lost hair, dandruff flakes, the very stuff of your gradual dismantling. soap, sugar, a pale fleck of semen, or the blood drop from a mouse the cat has carried in. It's all one grist to this mill that makes from our minute leftovers a tenacious state of curious arrangements. The males used up in copulation, females in work, life itself a blind contract between honeydew and carrion. The whole tribe surviving in that complex gap where horror and the neighbourly virtues, as we'd say, adjust to one another, and without question. Okay, that's the animal kingdom taken care of for a little bit. And on to the humans. Okay, so I don't treat them the same way at all. Needless to say, being one of them myself. But there are family poems, which are always risky, but When I have written about my children, I have tended to write about moments at which they're on the cusp of changing into some other condition, as it were. Those moments of parting of one kind or another. When you see your kid, and the children don't know you're seeing them like this, but at the stage where they've shifted from one zone of life into another. And I think a number of the poems I've done have always been on that threshold, those liminal moments, for the reasons that make me particularly engaged by the issue of time and change, I suppose, which kind of runs under like an underground stream in a lot of the stuff that I do. This one is, some of you have heard, I know, because I've been talking to people today and friends of mine and poets, friends of mine who have heard me read this, and probably my editor has heard me read it before anyway, but apologies to them. Son went to UVA, okay, University of Virginia, and there's a great lawn there that's used for very ceremonial occasions like graduations and honorary degrees and that kind of stuff. And it was, as the whole campus was, designed by gentleman whom the boys and girls referred to as Mr. Jefferson, Mr. Jefferson being the Jefferson we know. It's a gorgeous campus, anyway. The lawn is used for various things, among other things, the great ceremonial of streaking. And streaking is the subject of this poem because my son came home after his first year and said, I did something, do you want to know about it? And I said, so told me they streaked. He did say, well, it wasn't that hard because it was kind of in the break, you know. So there was his and his mates, but it was tricky because it was cold. Anyway, streak of light. After a party to celebrate the midterm break, you and your friends stripped after midnight and streaked from one end of that great lawn to the other, from the dignified rotunda pillars to the bronze tip of Homer's nose, streaked over the prospect Mr. Jefferson laid out, who never imagined the moonlit spectacle of six young first-year men in their pelts dashing across the grass on goat feet, dashing to touch the poet's nose and back over frosted grass to the steps, the safety of their clothes again, breathless, the deed done. Thinking about it, it's only your body I see, and only in shrapnel flashes, the streaking light of it on light feet, your red head thrown forward, netting specks of moonfire, the long strides and solid thighs of you, stretched fingers tipping bronze as you turn a runner, something Greek, your sex chilled by night and frost, but still in its strength, sending you headlong through the dark like a cast spear in Homer, glimmering and singing its flight. The moon is remote, neoclassical, over where, among the young men loudly hurrying into their clothes, you catch your breath, and I find, however it is, the rest of your life branching from this rite of frosted passage, this caper that stays in my mind as an image of separation. The sight of your freshly stubbled face alight like that, your vulnerable buttocks, the fleet gleaming ghost of you disappearing through air the frost has turned to icy water, and I stare, rejoicing as if I just hugged and waved you off on some extraordinary venture, stare after you, even after the night has done what it has to do and swallowed you, even after that last glimmer is gone from my eye. Okay, and here's, thanks. Thanks, gives me time to breathe. Thank you. This is a girl poem. I don't mean that in any sense, except it's about, sorry, not a girl poem. My daughter, it's a poem that has my daughter as its, she, when she was quite young, all of these kids are now grown, I mean, grown up to a certain degree anyway. So grown up to get married, enough to be married. And when she was very young, 6 or 7, as with so many young girls in particular, it happens to boys too, I presume, learned dancing and so on, and everything became, and music and singing, and everything became that in her life. It was lovely to see, to spy on in some ways. And she had a music teacher who was a Catholic, very devout Catholic, who taught her Latin hymns. Hymns I knew as a kid in boarding school, like Tantum Ergo and Panis Angelicus, gorgeous hymn. I was in the cathedral this morning saying a prayer that this would go okay, and I was sitting there, and suddenly there came Salve Regina over the intercom that they have that. It was gorgeous, because that's the hymn we sang. I've never written about it, but it's one of the most memorable things for me. We sang every night after the rosary in my 5 years of boarding school. And it's a gorgeous hymn, if you get a chance, St. Bernard's hymn. Anyway, nothing to do with this particular poem, basically, except that she was singing Latin as well. Caterpillar and Dancing Child. And I'm thinking of the caterpillar in its evolving metamorphic phase, and it becomes a butterfly. Caterpillar and Dancing Child. 'Tisn't only the child in the head it is, but this one who dances her life for us, turning like a miniature pillar of fire before us, spinning on the tip of her toes and spinning, taking the milk to the kitchen. Or who'll float one step at a time up the stairs to bed, or pirouette in the mirror to see how her hair is, translating her life into such speechlessness, full of herself and the joy of it, moving, moving. Or who'll open our ears amazed to the sound of her singing a hymn of angel bread in Latin, till the house fills with it, the bread flies from the table, and the flowering crown of thorns in the corner twists light into itself, as if in scarce earth it could live forever, forever bright-eyed, in this house of cards where the cat is scooped up by a small pair of arms and forced close to our hearts. Yesterday, I missed by inches crushing a caterpillar underfoot in the spring-lit garden. Exact as a Japanese lacquered box, it was black-bodied, fringed, white-streaked, with tiny turquoise eyes on its flanks, and legs the color my beard was once. And I watched it ripple through grass stems, driven by the one leaf that speaks to its hunger, where it eats its fill and flows over a wilderness of grit, bright mica morsels marking its way. Not at the speed of light, but in the arms of it, putting one foot in front of the other and covering the ground as we do, towards that deep, undreaming sleep in which it will become, as our child is, a life dancer. Right, and I'll go on. It being Valentine's Day tomorrow, I better not leave out that other good zone. This is a zone, it's part of a poem, I'll only read part of it, it's called At Home in Winter, but it's two bits, I'll read the second bit. It's about the, I suppose, the erotic in the midst of the domestic. Let's take a little sip of this. Blown in from the noon-white bite of snow, I find the whole house fragrant as a haycock with the soup you've stirred up. Its spirit seeping into closets, curtains, bedrooms. A prosperous mix of chicken stock, carrots, garlic, onion, thyme. All morning you've wreathed your head in it, and now you turn to me like a minor deity of earth and plenty, hands dipped to the wrist in the flesh of vegetables, your fingers trailing threads from the mound of bones glistening on the countertop. You stand at the edge of a still life, glazed twists of onion skin, papery garlic sacks, bright carrot stumps, grass-green delicate stems of parsley, that little midden of bones. And I behold how in the middle of my daily life, a sober, snowbound house can turn to spirit of chicken, air a vegetable soul, and breathe on me, turning back to the stove, wooden spoon still steaming. You say, in no time now, we'll sit and eat. Which, as Dennis will have pointed out, and all you sophisticates in the audience, is a quote from George Herbert at the end of a poem called Love, So I Did Sit and Eat. It's a gorgeous poem. So I stole that little bit from Herbert. This is a poem that has my mother in it to complete the family circle, or sort of more or less complete it, not quite, but I won't go on with it. But this is a poem from this most recent book called Lady Bird and Mother. And my mother was quite superstitious, and ladybirds were important, and you didn't kill one. So, Sunday air thronged to throttling with ladybirds, opening and closing their wings, tiny gold buttons that click and zip and glisten in the gold of October, and land on any leaf or level stretch of grass, or hot brick simmering in the glare. You used to see them one at a time, and there'd be a minute's rapture over the blessing of good luck. You'd make a wish and watch the diminutive creature stretch its wings and lift off the kitchen windowsill and vanish into the branches of our neighbor's apple tree. But why this black-freckled red or yellow beetle conveyed good fortune, your guess was as good as mine, though we knew it was under Our Lady's protection. One more leftover from the age of faith you still lived in, its garden appetites gobbling aphids, making this six-legged carapace a seasonal benediction, as it still is for farmers, a sign of health and green leaf and blossom, auguring a fine spring, no one wanting to bring down out of the innocent blue the bad luck in killing one, cleaving the clear line of connection spreading from all corners of that coleopterous cradle world to the two of us crunching into a ripe pippin. 'Twas our kind of superstition, small enough to fit in a kitchen garden, and not needing, as scarab or scorpion needs, the sands of Egypt or the vasty belts of Africa to dazzle in. This very minute, the luck of it, my west-facing window has a dozen contemplative ladybirds flickering in their Sabbath trance on it. And listen, come back, they're whispering, and wish on us. So, okay. Whoa, how time flieth. I've got this thing here. It's great. Okay, well, I've only got two more books to get through in 11 minutes. Okay, I'll read a little poem from this book that has all 10-line untitled poems, and they really are sort of little thickening of moments. I kind of look at things and watch them and see what's going on in them. And in this one, it's just looking at the garden and thinking about my neighbor. So they don't have any title. Bent over his time-polished pitchfork, my neighbor who's turning hay in the big wind blowing off the Atlantic is the moving hieroglyph for man who belongs here, or 200 years ago, which is also the sign of a local tree, the sycamore bearing its pied bark and giving leafy tongue to the air's passage through it, that long run-on sentence, trembling towards its final verb, which can be days coming, during which one invisible blackbird goes on making music, becomes an inky swirl on shadow paper, a sounding heart in the heart of uproar, a brushed text that would say, could we see it, high wind, morning all tossed about. His incendiary yellow-ringed eye running rings out to the rings of Saturn. I guess one of the things I was trying to do in many of the poems in that little book were connect the big and the small. You know, the big rings of Saturn and the rings and the blackbird's eye, and in this I mention Avon, which I'm thinking of Shakespeare. So this is a curious one where Shakespeare suddenly pops up. When I see the quick ripple of a groundhog's back above the grass, its earth-brown pelt vanishing into a hedgerow, which for a minute or two is a shaken screen of greens and then again still, the creature melted into nature's mouth and sending back no sign of itself, though I know it's in there, and I can sense how its breath and the broadly distributed embrace of its gaze have become so fully what it inhabits, it will even winter there, curled around its own heart, beating at quarter speed, at ease in the sphere of its own immediate knowings. Then, for some reason, Avon's native comes to mind, Quillend tipping his tongue as he takes a breath and disappears into the leaves and lavish music of another turbulent little word shiver for a minute. And he's all alone there, listening. One thinks of Shakespeare actually writing things, you know, which is an extraordinary thought to me, at very least. And one is hard to get your head around writing down pieces from King Lear or pieces from, as it turns out, the Scottish play Macbeth. I'm going to read a poem now that's in prose. I hope it's a poem. I have a few prose in this most recent book, Out of Breath. I have a few prose, and in this American edition of it, that'll come. There's a number of prose poems, and this is one of them. Wrote a little bit. It's impossible to respond to something of the enormity of something like 9/11. I mean, it's really tricky to get your head around language that actually gets at it. So one makes one's little attempts, and this is one of those little attempts. It's called Afterword, and there's a italicized subtitle, The Teacher Thinks About His Students. I was actually teaching Macbeth at the time, and I was particularly thinking when I wrote this of that scene in Macbeth where Macduff is told about the death of his children and his wife by Macbeth, and he can't speak. He pulls his hat over his head. Obviously, that's the implicit stage direction, and somebody says, "Well, speak," and he says, "Yeah, I'd say something about it soon, but first I have to feel it." And there's that sense of speechlessness. So, in this afterword, the teacher thinks about his students. All they want is adequate speech, so we reach across the great plains of the classroom table, tripping over our words. It will never be enough. Eyes of the lost, tears where one is looking at me, trying to speak. What man? Ne'er pull your hat about your brows. When I draw down the blinds, a sky of rubble and smoke is swept away to nothing, a blank. I know this script, it beggars translation. Dispute it like a man. Syllable by syllable, the story, is coming out of red headbands, box cutters, plastic knives, a book of simple instructions, barking and barked, lovingly, yes, at one another. First this, then that, then the other, and we are, praise heaven, home. Poor eyes drowning and no one to ask. Please, is my name on your list? It is my father. No, is there another list? When the book is passed from hand to hand, it falls open at smoke. It hurts to squint through it, a grievous affliction. To imagine we might loosen our tongues, that we might go on. They've gone home now, hungry as field mice in February, in silence, not one crumb of comfort among them. And in spite of such things, I guess is the way to put it, there are other things too, and we have to kind of turn back to the world. And this was a kind of turning back to the world. It's called The Search, and it was prompted by my seeing the clematis, you know, the clematis, and the way it goes to absolutely nothing, to this kind of dead wood. And next thing, all this purple stuff. It's such a resurrection. Anyway, that prompted this. The Search. It's the sheer tenacity of the clematis clinging to rusty wire and chipped wood fence that puts this sky blue flare and purple fire in its petals. To be new in autumn, in mid-September, to be showing yourself like that, naked as water under full moonlight. Something has to be good in such a world. in the talent it has for lasting and coming back, in the way it decorates our graves, our standing walls, our back porches, and in the way the late bee lands on its dazzle, walks the circumference of every petal in some minor key of astonishment, drinking the last of its sapphire wine. What takes shape is a cellular sense of how the moment is jammed to splitting with excess, each pod and sweet kernel plumped to bursting with the brash simplicities of contradiction, the child's tears watering the plant that seems from a shrivel of bones to make itself an azure conflagration, seeming to say, there's always more to say. Language can be like that, taking its stand on the driest, most barren space of clay, asking only that we attend, behold it being no more than being itself, and nothing blooming. And tonight the old man, your father, smiled twice. Once when he'd reached the sofa after the 50-mile shuffle from the hall door. Once when his tongue tasted the tart cool of a spoonful of blueberries, and he turned his eyes, shining their milky blue, on the child, who lifted her brimming spoon and smiled back at him. Right, I've got a couple more to read. I mean, I've a couple more minutes to do, so I've got to fill these minutes. I'll try something that I've just written. So, and God knows if this one works, but let's see what happens with it. If it's there, it's another little prose poem for a piece. In Renville, as in lots of places where I live, in lots of places in Ireland, there are these tiny little spaces where rest the bones of the unbaptized kids. Relic na Lanav, they were outside the church. And of course, it's a big thing. It was a big scandal. And there was a big movement recently to get them to... Anyway, I responded to that, and it's called Baby Graves. One word. It's a bit of prose. In the abandoned briar-embraced graveyard of lost children, the small birds pay no mind to what the magpies of bad faith decided, since nothing in or out of nature could be further from the truth of these bones than the hand of an imagined God who'd let them moulder in some merciless blank spot, cast out and aching with unslakable desire, their brief, unrealized lives eclipsed twice over. Walking among tiny, anonymous headstones, I want the souls of these short-lived bodies to be there, in glimmer tips of the wind-bent grass, in each plump, polished seed of every blackberry, giving airy, untroubled ear to how the robin and the wren are paraphrasing Johnson's poem for his first daughter, singing their sturdy little hearts out, calling the ground to witness what has gone into it, which cover lightly gentle earth. That last bit is from Johnson. It's a gorgeous poem by Ben Johnson on My First Daughter, it's called. Here lies to both her parents, to each her parents, Ruth, Mary, the daughter of their youth. And it goes on for about 10 lines. It's a perfect poem. Okay, two tiny things left, and then we are done. Okay. This is a poem back to painting. And I'm ending with two poems, two small poems that have art in some ways as their point, I suppose. Because, you know, that's what we do. And the doing of it is always staring you in the face as a kind of endless chore, an endless attack. Eliot called it an attack on the unspeakable, I think. When Beckett was asked about how to do art, he summed it all up in two words, which were simply, fail better. So that came to my mind as I'm reading this book about Chardin, that gorgeous 18th century painter of landscapes, a lot of landscapes, of portraits and people and scenes and still lifes, in particular the still lifes. Anyway. All his life, we're told, Chardin struggled to overcome his lack of natural talent. So I begin to look again at his olives and peaches, at that cut-open cantaloupe with its orange innards on show. or that orange from Seville he kept giving a bit part to burn softly in its given space, to weight the picture in a newly luminous way. Or how the dead rabbit's fur is a dry gleam of white at the heart of warm browns. Or the way each feather in the dead red partridge is a live thing, the bird's life stilled to this final exposure of itself. The struggle, you see, is with the facts themselves, and with some knowledge he kept hidden from our eyes, some unspoken sense of how there these bodies are, and nothing can say it the way it is. Only you look again, stretch your hand, dip the bristles, risk again the failing stroke. And finally, a bird poem to end entirely with, and thanking you for your courtesy and silence, and it's really lovely to read here. I reiterate my thanks to everybody who's made this possible, I must say, in this marvellous city. Is it a city? Is it a town? Is it a city? It's a beautiful place. It's about... I was thinking today when I was walking around, it is, as much as Venice is, it is entirely of itself. There is nothing like Santa Fe in the world, it would seem to me. Anyway, I say that as a stranger, but I hope not as an impertinent one. It has an art inflection, and it is that instance when you know that the good stuff happens in what you do in art and in lots of other things, anything you commit yourself to, love, among other things, that the good stuff happens out of left field and by accident. And I was in Providence, in Provincetown, one winter, and I saw something overhead that suggested that to me. So here it is. Detail. I was watching a robin fly after a finch, the smaller bird chirping with excitement, the bigger its breast blazing, silent in light-winged, earnest chase. When out of nowhere, over the chimneys and the shivering front gardens, flashes a sparrowhawk headlong, a light brown burn, scorching the air from which it simply plucks, like a ripe fruit, the stopped robin, whose two or three cheeps of terminal surprise twinkle in the silence, closing over the empty streets when the birds have gone about their own business. And I began to understand how a poem can happen. You have your eye on a small, elusive detail pursuing its music when a terrible truth strikes and your heart cries out, being carried off. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Right.
So here we are again, the Irish tenor and his accompanist. Now that he says he can sing Salve Regina, we have an option on him as a sort of celebrant doing plain chant as well. I'm told by the engineer, by the way, that my microphone was trying to sort of shout me down earlier on, so we'll try and keep it in its place for this part. Anyway, the obvious starting point for a conversation with Eamon Grennan seems to be with his brilliance with titles. I mean, here's somebody who has actually come up with titles like horses, ants, and he used up so many of them that he brought out an entire book with no titles at all. And yet, the titles of your books, Eamon, seem to me to be very carefully thought out. Some of them have many meanings. They're like little poems in themselves, the quick of it itself. Or what light there is, and so it goes, for instance. But now we have this peculiar thing with your new book, where actually it has two titles. It's got an Irish title called Out of Breath, as perhaps you are now after your reading.
Yeah, right.
And we have an American title, which is
Matter of Fact,
yeah. And it's hard to sort of tell. I mean, if we think of Out of Breath, it has a lot of kind of poetic resonance because breath, breathing, space, timing, inspiration are all there.
Right.
It has nothing at all in common with Matter of Fact. So I'm wondering, is this a kind of horse's ants title, or is it a quick of a title?
You said horse's ants.
Horses.
Ants, right. Okay.
Slash ants.
Not something else, right, okay.
Two of the most memorable titles.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll take the... To go from the bottom of your question first, the horse's ants part...
It's in my pants, you see.
But... The two titles, the American edition is a larger edition, and so there's more poems, and I spread them out in a different way. And as I looked at what could umbrella the collection, it was I came upon the title, matter of fact. It's not a title of any poem. I like titles to hover between possibilities. I think this is what you're suggesting too, Dennis, i.e., like what light there is either a shrug of dismay, you do it by what light there is, or it's, oh, wow, rapture. The quick of it is the similar thing. It's the quick of it, or it's how speedy things go, it's the heart of the matter, or it's how fast things go. Out of breath is obviously all the stuff you mentioned and being out of breath, but it's that the stuff comes out of breath. But matter of fact has the same sort of hover, because it's matter of fact. That's a very matter of fact way of talking, or it's matter of fact. It tries to focus on facts themselves and underline matter, material, which I think is what a good amount of the stuff in the book is doing. So I wonder why I do that sometimes, if not to resist easy signposts. I mean, obviously with horses and ants, I'm giving such easy signposts that who's to know what the poem is about, really, except it's about horses and ants. They are cats or whatever. But in other ways, I'm often trying to suggest some kind of position, amphibian, if you like, or liminal, if you like, between possibilities. It seems to me that possibly my own condition as a migrant or as, you know, caught between two places, probably prompts me to that. One doesn't want to know reason a lot of the time. One just wants to work with one's viscera and do it. But when you go back on it after a few years, you say, yeah, I was doing that. I wonder why. And I suspect one of these reasons might be my own condition between the two places, so that titles for me exist as a lot of the stuff I do in the poems themselves exists between possibilities. It's probably also a result of my own resistance to establishing a place in which one could say, he believes that, because I wouldn't want to be held to any particular belief. You know, I mean, it's as simple as that.
And there are two other things, in a way, that your poems kind of live amongst, as it were. I mean, one is, I suppose, a kind of narrative, linear kind of poem. Mm-hmm. And the other is a bit like the one about the hawk suddenly descending down on something.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to generalize, I think your work has moved broadly from this kind of narrative approach to a much more quick jab kind of writing. And along with that, your forms became somewhat more rigorous in the sense that all the poems in The Quick of It are 10 lines long. I think in Still Life with Waterfall, there are a number of 13-line poems. So I'm wondering, insofar as, after all, Helen Bender could write an entire book called The Breaking of Style, to talk about your own breaking of style, how you would regard that now retrospectively, and also whether you felt in becoming a kind of quick jab poet, it was necessary to have more rigorous forms to underpin that.
That's very good, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. That puts him on the spot.
His titles and his answers are becoming more and more alike.
Right, now to put you on the spot, but it really is. I mean, the thing I love about Dennis's work, obviously, is how informed it constantly is, as you could hear from that introduction and a question like that. And we talked a little bit earlier. I mean, I had about four volumes that had what you might call a sort of little lyrical narrative, a linearity in their composition of each poem. You know, I was working with a this happened, this happened, this happened, and lo. After I published, and then I published a selected poems, which sensed, you know, you think about your own set, you don't think about it in these ways except retroactively, as you're saying, retrospectively too. There's a kind of trajectory of those kind of things, and they ended with the book called Relations, which was a kind of gather 'em up of the earlier four books, plus some new poems. And I felt I wanted to do that because, exactly as you say, I thought I had exhausted a kind of trajectory, and in terms of subject matter as well as in terms of manner and in terms of attitude, in terms of looking at. I mean, an awful lot goes into a poem from the matter of the facts towards attitude, voice, and rhythms, and so on. Then in a poem called, or in a book called Still Life with Waterfall, the poems in that are much jumpier. Lots of them. They work at angles to one another. And I think I did that not consciously, because you don't do these things consciously. You're doing them, and then you see, that's what I did. And that's what I discovered I was doing. And then you kind of say, okay, I'll do that. I'll continue to do that. And I suspect that kind of reflected a certain amount of the stuff going on in my own life, about which I will maintain a rigorous silence. But it did require a less comfortable unfolding, as it were. And it got more... I like the jab issue, the boxing metaphor there. It got more angular. It got less... comfortable with itself. If the earlier ones were kind of lyrical narrative meditations, these later things were lyrical thoughts, you know. There were thoughts and feelings being put at angles to one another. And it did seem to me, and I hadn't noticed it until now, that in fact the formal stuff was trying to hold that stuff, hold that material in some kind of brace, to brace it in some way, both the 39 poems and indeed the other poems which are in stanzas and so on, in which there really is a kind of a sense of a lot of stuff and being held in from being too centrifugal, that there's the centripetal effort of form against the centrifugal effort of the material. And it, I like the notion, and I look for it in poems that I love and poets I love, of the counterpoint between the pressure of the matter and pushing this way and the pressure of the form pushing this way. Because when you get the two together, as you do, I mean, you know this yourself, you get a kind of tension that is its own, ultimately, music.
Right? But what has been consistent throughout your work, I think, is kind of keeping faith with the ordinary, with the observed, with the scene. Now, we hear a lot, you know, we're always hearing about poetry as a way of making the ordinary extraordinary. I think you do something quite subtly, interestingly different, which is you treat the ordinary as extraordinary in some way. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why you do that is what looks sometimes like celebrations, and they are in a way, but they're also they're full of awareness that at any moment this could become a much less tranquil scene, or the actual privileged moment is itself under threat of some kind. And I think that is a tension which is not at all obvious on a first reading of the poems, but you wonder, why are these working? Why do they not seem just complacent? But in fact, it seems to me that there's a kind of inner challenge, as if implicit in the celebratory and the ordinary is that possibility. As
I like this, I want you to review my next book, if you don't mind, okay? Because you got your first paragraph there. It's great. I loved hearing that. I think the under threat thing is always there. There is always, I mean, any light has shadow. I mean, any object in light is casting shadow. So the attempt of the poem, to me, is always to bring the shadow and the light into some sort of consonance, some sort of awareness of each other. So there is, you know, as a sort of brought up Catholic, there is always a sense, incarnational sense, in your reaction, yours too. You exploit it in a different way from me, and you regard it in a different way probably from me too. But for me, there's always that slight sense in which, without that faith, what is there in the facts that can still elicit from one a tremor of celebratory response? And not awe, a little wonder maybe, but trying to diminish it because it can get sentimental very easily. And the way not to let it become sentimental numinosity, as it were, would be to not surround it with halos, but to try to coax out of itself light. But as you coax light out of something, you're aware of the shadow and the threat and the momentary and the passing of that light, you know, of its loveliness in your eyes is for that moment. It's why, even when I'm writing about the children, for example, it's always those moments which are tinged in some way by those threats. And the threat is temporality. The threat is time. So I do think that I would like to feel that it was a kind of celebration of the ordinary, but I would also like to feel that celebration and elegy are in some kind of way parts of the same whole. And that the truth of things comes through by allowing each its verbal space, its linguistic space, its linguistic verve and presence. You know, does that make sense? Yeah.
And you said in an interview with Meter magazine, I think it was a while ago, that you have ahistorical and apolitical instincts, and that you're drawn more to ethical and personal zones. So, nonetheless, there are a number of poems, the one you read to do with 9/11 tonight. Yeah. I'm thinking also of Angel Looking Away, yeah. Headlines, poems like that, which are fairly explicitly referring to the things that everybody's eyes naturally fall on and then are kind of averted from. Yeah. But for you to write about something like 9/11, I think, is unusual in the sense that you'd almost be the poet I would expect not to have written about it. And interestingly, the angle that you took towards it is really to do with the failure of language. Mm-hmm. It's a very almost poet related take on it. And so I'm interested in how you came to write a couple of poems about that topic, mm-hmm. and how you think as a poet the language can somehow, I mean, you've seen in another interview, you said that something like 9/11 or the war in Iraq is a failure of language in the end. Mm-hmm. So instead of, as it were, just writing about the horror qua horror, you're actually dealing with it, as I say, from a very poetry-centered point of view, mm-hmm. to considerable effect, the failure of language. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, could you say something about what, as it were, drove you to write yeah. on this topic, and how you think a poet can help in a situation like Iraq or 9/11 to avoid language failing whoever or yeah. whomever?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and we'd be here till midnight trying to answer it, you know, in any kind of expansively adequate way. But, you know, I mean, the big stuff, the big things, the horrors do, I mean, to go back to one point you made, the failure of language as being in some ways responsible, it always seems responsible. I mean, when diplomacy fails, and diplomacy is the art of language, war happens, all that, you know, so I would just take a very simple view of that, that people killing one another is the failure of people talking to one another, you know, I mean, and one won't work. If one doesn't work, then the other is resorted to. Why I would respond was it was there, and it was I was incapable of not responding at the same time as not wanting, just because of my own makeup, to simply write a poem about the event. So I was very conscious of the innocent and corollary and collateral damage of that to these kids, these students, not kids, they're young men and women, who were so injured by something for which, in our talk, I mean, I was poet and teacher in this case. I was quite conscious of that, and so I had nothing to tell them that was in any sense something that would manage that particular pain, and so you concentrate and you make that the point. As one often does in writing, the inability to do something is itself a subject. So my feeling in both the three poems that I wrote developed from, prompted by the 9/11 events, were again attempts to, I probably would get a lot of criticism for this, but attempts to register some kind of understanding of something that you can't really finally speak about. In this case, even in that poem, which is really concentrated on my students and our inability and remembering the Shakespeare, which is, again, an acknowledgement of inability to respond properly, it was trying to be, in some terrible way, even-handed. Is trying to be, to say, all the stuff that goes into that horrible event cannot be easily separated, and one side of it becoming clean, one side of it becoming righteous, as it were. So that's what I was trying to do.
Is there any relevance in the fact, or are we to take any particular meaning from the fact that these poems are written in prose?
Yeah.
Now, there is a development towards prose, actually, in this recent work. Mm-hmm. I think you say in a note something to the effect that it is a different kind of musical prompt is yeah. behind the prose poem. So I'm wondering, A, the relevance of these 9/11 ones being yeah. in prose rather than verse, and also just a few words maybe about your moving into prose poetry yeah. more.
Yeah, well, the 9/11 poems, I just didn't feel I could find the music for, you know, lines just weren't going to work for me. It needed sentences jagged and impulsive to respond so that the piece on the page, and other poets would find ways into it through lines. Galway Kinnell has a fine poem about it. Heaney has a couple of interesting poems about it, and others too, of course. But for me, I just didn't, I may have tried to write it, but trying to put it into the formal attractiveness of verse struck me as against the grain of the content somehow. So I was just working according to my own light on that one and according to my own reflex. Mm. So that was fairly, I couldn't, I did write a poem in prose, but it was about the American appointment verse. That was about an element of American response, I mean, i.e. beginning a war. And that was kind of in a fairly small little poem that felt it could, because it was about planes flying, it could find its way into verse. But I don't think in the end there's any absolute in the distinction between the two, that one poet will say X and another will say another. For me, it just happened that way. It was the right kind of music to look for, if there was music at all in the response. As far as moving in towards writing more poems, prose poems, falling in with what lots of other poets are probably doing, trying to make sense of that kind of hybrid condition. I mean, it is a sort of centaur, the prose poem, you know. It has two... When you write a poem, you have two forms of orchestration, you know, and both of them work with one another in an interesting dance-like way, i.e. you have the line which perpetually holds you to a sweetness of expression, you know, line, line, line. And you have a sentence which is making sense and it's moving towards completion. The way I've explained it to my students sometimes is in a kind of with a sexual metaphor, which we needn't go into. Mm-hmm. But it is.
Why not?
but yeah. It's two kinds of pleasure: yeah. The pleasure of getting to a point, yeah. And the pleasure of maintaining pleasure, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But you have those two pleasures in a poem, particularly free verse poems, but all poems, it seems to me, work in the way they push the language, the way they push the line against the sentence, the way they dance with one another. Now, in the prose poem, you only have the sentence, and so all of your musical sense is going into this making of sentences. You don't have the, as I was talking today, you don't have enjambment to help you. You don't have that end of the line, little bounce to help you. You have a much different form of surface to jump on. And so, for me, again, it was a question of, when I'm writing these prose poems, of trying to hear prose working, sentences working, trying to hear sentences working. Mm. And I think there was a kind of development, because those 13-line poems and the 10-line poems were all working towards making a single sentence, too, you know, in lines. Mm. So, I think there is a different kind of music, but you're still looking for music. You're still after a certain kind of music.
Well, Eamon, since you mentioned sexual metaphor, and you reminded me in the reading that even though an Irishman may think the world centers around St. Patrick's Day, that there is this thing called Valentine's Day coming up as well. And so I thought my final question should be about... there's a kind of erotic... pleasure in the way that you use language, a kind of erotic relish in the way you use language. And at the same time, you're capable of writing very beautifully, very specifically, I won't say explicitly, right, about love and so on. So I thought maybe you'd end with a few words about how you see the erotic functioning in poetry, in language and in subject matter, and how the love poem survives the state of its health in St. Valentine's Day 2008.
Two questions. Two simple questions to end with, yes. I would say the erotic is essential to the poem. I mean, it's the life force, and I remember somebody praising a poem of mine in a way I really loved, because it was a poem about... garbage cans, and this other poet, she said, so sexy. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, okay. And what she was talking about, it wasn't a fetish or anything, you know, with garbage cans, but yeah, it was, and I do think it does go back once again to a kind of music, but also to me, as it went, you know, the poems and poems are against death in some ways, and the erotic is the against death outside the poem. I'm making this up as I go along, obviously, you know, I mean, at least I'm thinking it not on my feet, but so I do think the erotic is an essential component. I can't imagine that poems are without it, regardless of their topic or their matter. That the erotic as a state of desire and a state of energy is absolutely at the center of the music of poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's why poetry remains central to our use of the language, because it reminds us that the language itself is itself the erotic act that it is, because it is at the center of communication. Mm. It's at the center of being seen and seeing, you know, and that's what the erotic does too. What was the second part?
How you see the state health of the love poem.
There's good stuff. Robert Haas is a poet who writes, you're not averse to it yourself. I am...
I'm trying to encourage the audience to be creative in their cards tomorrow, at least. I think we'll leave it at that.
Note.
And speaking of audience, I mean, it's been a wonderfully attentive, responsive, encouraging audience. And you were terrific. And I'm most grateful to you for that attention and that responsiveness. And I'd like to thank the crew here in the Lensic, to thank our photographer, Don Usner, the bookstore people from Garcia Books, who keep faith with the word and the book in the internet age. We'll be selling books outside, and there'll be a signing session as well. And, of course, I want to end again by thanking the people who've made it all possible. That is the Leonard Foundation. Eamon was educated in Tipperary. I grew up in Tipperary, and you'd have to go a long, long way to find people as generous and as inspiring as the Leonard Foundation.
Hear, hear.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.